All right, a few pieces of business. I got homework from everybody. Thanks for getting that to me. Solutions should go up before lecture on Thursday. Realize those videos didn't go up. Those notes I thought were, you know, things pretty easy, intuitive material that's in those notes. I will post videos still. The hotel Wi-Fi was terrible, so couldn't post them from Nevada, but should have gotten them up since before now, but will. And actually, those lectures, that series of lectures that the notes were posted for last week, that's all of Chapter 4. It's just really about the linkages and rolling. So it's kind of constraints on kinematic constraints. So we'll look back through probably Thursday, work another example from Chapter 4, but that's pretty much it, and you'll have some homework. Your next homework is due not this Friday, but the following. So I'll get that posted sometime in the next 24 hours as well. So you have almost 2 weeks to work on that. So today we're going to start on Chapter 5, which talks about inertial effects for rigid bodies. We'll look at largely how Newton's laws extend to systems of particles, and then therefore to discuss rigid bodies. So as a reminder, Newton's laws, strictly speaking, only apply to particles. Right, so there's actually no rotational component to Newton's laws at all. Right. However, as we'll see, they do extend, and he did capture some important effects that apply to rigid bodies. Okay, so let's get rolling. We're going to talk first about a system of just two particles. So let's draw one there. Sure I match the orientation of the two to the notes. Get them in the right order. So we have two particles, J and K. And these are point masses, infinitely small, so they don't have any rotation of their own. All right. And we're going to describe them in a relative to some point A over here. All right, and so we can write the position vectors for each of these. That should be a straight line. So position of particle J with respect to A. Right. We have the position particle K with respect to A. Okay, particle J has some external force on it. So call force on J. Particle K has some external force on it. Direction doesn't really matter for our purposes here. Force on K. And then we know that these two guys could have some force on each other. Right, some internal reaction forces. And what we're going to do is a notation. So, these internal forces are reactions. So what did Newton tell us about those reactions? Equal and opposite. So, in this sense, we know they're vectors. So the equal part applies to their amplitude, the opposite to the direction. Right. So we know that that is true. Keep in mind that these are vectors. Well, if this is true, what we know about the moments that those two forces create about A? Well, what is the moment that this guy creates about A?
The magnitude times the R.
Yes. What order? Which one's first? I understand cross product.
F cross R.
Sure about that? It's R cross F. Small f. Okay. J, comma, K. Okay. So in this sense, and it kind of you can intuitively think about it, this one's creating a moment about A in that direction. Right? This one's creating a moment in that direction. So these guys end up being equal and opposite as well. So we have the kind of internal forces are canceling, and then the moments that result from those internal forces are canceling as well. Okay. Kind of makes some sense, I think. All right, so let's look at the Newton's second law for these two particles. All right. So we can look at the sum of the forces on J is what? Well, we have the external forces on J plus those internal forces. And what does that equal?
MA.
What M? What A?
M of J and A of J.
Mass of particle J, acceleration of particle J. Right I. Sum of the forces on K, right? So we just have the external force, internal force, and then what does that equal? Yep, just with K, that's right. So let's look at the sum of all the forces on this particular particle system then. Well, that's just, we can take each particle in our system and write. And if we had n different particles, you could just repeat this forever. So we can substitute terms in, right? If we do this, J, what happens to those two guys in this equation?
Cancel.
Yeah, they're going to cancel, just from our reasoning there. So we have FJ. So external forces, right? And those two guys, well, we know that has to be true too. Okay, so we've said kind of, well, this kind of indicates those internal forces are going to cancel. Well, this kind of shores it up for us that only the external forces are contributing to the acceleration of the particles within the system. All those internal forces are going to cancel for us. Okay, so that's nice. We don't have to try to calculate these for every particle in our body, right? Which would be a real pain if we had to do that. So let's look similarly to some of the moments about point A. Anybody? Not necessarily. All cross F for each one. Right. So we can write that. What does that equal? There's one simplification you should be able to make right away. What's this? Right. And we'll see where that crops up in just a minute that you probably haven't necessarily seen before in undergrad dynamics. because of this, right, we saw that the kind of moments resulting from those internal forces are going to cancel out. So we still are just going to, we are going to end up J relative to A cross. With only the moments resulting from external forces contributing to the moments about point A. So in both cases, only the external forces matter, or moments resulting from external forces. Both acceleration and some of our moments. Okay. And this extends out for n different bodies. Right? Here we've just kind of worked through intuitively with two bodies. But if you have n different bodies in this system of points, this exact thing extends out there. Right? So we could write our n points in our kind of point mass system, which could be forming a body, and will be forming a body in just about 5 minutes. Right. Some of the forces on that body. That's why that should be I. Make sure I match that. Yep. And of course, we have the other side of that equation we can write as well. If we have endpoints as part of our body. With me so far? Yes, you guys don't look so confident about it. All right, well, let's look at that first term. All right. All right. We're going to say, hey, that m is constant. Well, how else could we write that acceleration term? dvdt, or take one more of those. Right? We can take that all the way out. Okay. And we do that to define something. That term you'll see discussed and called the first moment of mass. Okay. Okay. All right. I'm going to erase this figure for right now. I think we're done with the points. So if we do this and we sum over all the points in a body, a rigid body, okay. Well, we can define the system mass, right, is really just the summation over all those points in the body, all those individual points, right? Kind of makes some sense, I think. Right. I have a body comprised of a bunch of points. If I add up the mass of all those individual points, I get the whole body's mass. Hopefully that makes sense. All right, I'm also going to write the position. So we define G as the center of mass. We're going to write, say, the position of that center of mass with respect to some fixed origin O. So we don't, we just have some values in the Cartesian, fixed Cartesian frame that define the position of that mass. Okay. So I want to look at this. Okay. Well, I know that is that. Well, if I look at that, I know that, well, I can also do this. Make sure I get this one right. Equivalent to that. So if we sum up all the points of mass and their locations, right? Basically the definition of center of mass here is what we're doing. Yes, Mia. Okay. So what that means is that over here, right, if we have a constant mass, right? We can look at the sum of the forces on the entire system, right? How's that? Okay. So if we assume that that system mass is constant, which we most generally do, right? It's, might not be in the actual case, right? If you're dealing with rockets or spaceships or rapidly changing vessels that are burning fuel in some way. So it's not always constant, but if it is, we can take it out. We know it's constant. And then we end up with what is this term? So what Newton predicted basically holds for the center of mass of a collection of points. Predicted the motion of the center of mass of a rigid body. Okay. Well, let's look at kind of moments in this case. What holds for that? Could do a kind of similar derivation. We'll skip a couple of steps. Full things in the book, I believe. operation. Point A, actually. And we end up with something like that, where what do we call that HA term?
Angular momentum.
Yeah. So this guy is just angular momentum. And we can look at this term, what does that look like? Linear momentum, it's kind of a special case, and it's a linear momentum of particles kind of relative to a frame centered at A. So it's not the kind of total momentum, but it's something like linear. Something like linear momentum. Approximately linear momentum. And we can actually often simplify that term. Okay. So all our derivations so far to get us to these kind of fundamental equations for linear motion, rotational motion, have not assumed that the location of point A is fixed. Right? We've had a collection of particles. Right? So all this so far could apply to a fluid. Could apply to a deformable body where the center of mass location is actually changing. So we haven't said A is fixed. We haven't said really that G is fixed at a location in the body or a collection of points. Well, for most of the systems that, at least in here, we're going to work with, it usually is, right? The center of mass is kind of at a fixed place in the body if the mass is not changing. Its location is not changing. So that's going to simplify a lot of this for us. So let's kind of look at that case now. So if we require, so let's say we're going to fix if we go from a collection of points and now say point A is fixed within it, we can basically say then that we're going to be forming a body. Right? The location of these points are not changing relative to each other any longer. Well then if I look at any point on that body, what's its velocity going to be with respect to point A?
It's the same body, it should be the same point. It's going to be like VI, assuming the frame is fixed kind of thing.
So you can write out the full thing, right? So VI, X, Y, Z, plus what? If it's a rigid body, what is this term? Zero. Right, we kind of went through that 2 weeks ago or something, right? Two points on the same rigid body. They don't have any relative velocity because they're on a rigid body. Right, so the velocity at point only has the contribution from the rotational component of the body. Okay. So that means that the angular momentum equation can simplify for us a bit. Looks like that now. So now let's look back at this equation. All right. So hold on to this form. I'm going to erase it to give us room to think about our moment equation. All right. Write it back up if we need to. Okay. Going to simplify version. I can maybe write it here too. 1 to n. Okay, so if we're going to calculate the moments about point A, right, and we say we can kind of get to all the stuff over there that calculates the angular momentum, we can take that derivative pretty easily. What in this equation is going to give us trouble for calculating moments about some point? Is figuring out the mass of the system hard?
No.
Is figuring out where the center of mass relative to the point we're rotating about hard?
No.
No. Is figuring out that term hard, the angular momentum? Do we know the position of the particle relative to A for the body? Yeah. We know the angular velocity of the body. We know that. So, do we know this? Acceleration of point A? Well, sometimes we might, but in the general case, that's often what we're trying to solve for here. So, this term, right, we're going to say, hey, that angular, the sum of the moments about point A is somehow dependent upon the acceleration of that point. We'd like to avoid that if we can. So how can we avoid that? There's a few cases. Okay. What's the first one? We want that term to go to zero. What are the ways that can go to zero? That's close, but not quite.
If they're parallel to each other.
Yeah. So basically, we want the cross. It means you're looking at, hey, the total cross product goes to zero. What does that mean about the relationship between the acceleration of point A and the vector from A to the center of mass? You're lying. So acceleration is directly, and for all time, right, either towards the center of mass or away from the center of mass. And again, we're talking not instantaneously, for all time, they have to be. For that to be zero for all time, if you're looking at the overall cross product. Okay? Since I drew three, probably can guess there's a two in there somewhere. What are the other two ways that can go? There's one trivial one right away, but we're not going to consider that. What's that? The mass is zero. We're not going to worry about that one. Okay? What are the other ways? No. I think simpler than that. What are the terms here? All right, we just said if this guy goes to zero, goes to zero. If that's zero, what does that mean for point A? Right. Point A is the center of mass. Okay? What else can happen? Acceleration is zero, which is kind of what you're suggesting. But basically that means we're in pure rotation. Okay, so a pendulum that's fixed. Point A is here, it's rotating. So undergrad vibrations. You guys saw that all the time. Okay. So here's three conditions. How often does this one happen? Point three. Almost never. We almost never will use this one. Rolling being one specific case. Rolling without slipping, actually. If you have any slipping and rolling, even that doesn't apply. Right. So we use these first two all the time. The third one very, very rarely. Okay. So we want those things to apply. The thing to remember here is we get to choose, in general, where we place A, where we're summing our moments about. Right. So you get to make a choice so that one of these things holds. Right. And this is one place where we say that, hey, dramatic, proper choice of frames and locations and where you sum moments and all those kind of things and dramatically reduce the complexity of the problem. This is one of those. Okay. So if that happens, if one of these three points hold, one, two, or three holds, okay. We see that first term goes to zero. You end up with the sum of the moments about point A is just the rate of change with respect to time over the angular momentum. I would guess you maybe have seen this in undergrad dynamics, the simplified form, without getting to where it came from. Right. And you may not even have seen it this form, but probably saw it as individual components rather than a vector notation. Okay. Can we write the force equation the same way? In a similar form? Probably. Why else would I be asking about it, right? Okay. Well, let's look at this, right? So this guy is just M system that, right? Well, this guy's not changing, so I could bring the ddt out. Just that. Well, what is this term? That's just the linear momentum. Typically, we'll write that as p. So you also can see that some of the forces is p dot, rate of change of linear momentum. Of which Newton's law is actually a special case. Right? Because Newton's assuming that mass is fixed always. Right? It's a point mass, its mass is not changing. Right. But the system mass could be changing. So that's where this is actually a more general form. All right, you have rockets or a truck that's leaking fuel or a dump truck or something like that that's changing mass as you're trying to figure out its dynamics. Satellite that's burning fuel. Okay. So from that, we have effectively equations that describe the how our system's going to move, if we're able to fill in all those terms for a given rigid body or a system of rigid bodies. And that's largely what the rest of the semester is about at the highest level. It's taking these equations and applying them to actual systems. Right? what we'll get to, in addition to this, and this is kind of a Newton-Euler method, we'll get to energy-based methods. Before we look at energy, questions about this? All right. What's that? Sure, that's fine. Please ask. We're going to keep moving forward if you guys don't have questions. So, we can take a similar approach to get to the kinetic energy, total kinetic energy for a system of particles, and then therefore as an extension of rigid body. Right. Book has that derivation. I think it's not, we labor the point to do two very similar derivations, one for energy, one for forces and one for energy. So we'll just write what these are and discuss quickly. And they're in section 5.1.3. If you wanted to follow along with that derivation, how to get from a collection of points to total kinetic energy for a rigid body. Okay. If you're talking about total kinetic energy for a rigid body, we'll typically write kinetic energy as T. What is it? 1/2 mv². Wrong. That's a very special case. It's not the general case. So I'll give you, there's 1/2 there. Right. And maybe I'll give you the M too. What's the V squared part in the general case?
V dotted with V.
V of what?
V of, well, the sum of all the Vs of the particles.
Maybe.
The V of the center of mass.
Yeah. Okay. What else? That's only part of it. What part of the energy does this capture?
The linear.
It captures only translational energy.
Oh, okay.
So there should be some kind of rotational component here for your rigid body. What's that? So this equation for kinetic energy of a body is valid for all motion. Okay. So we have some component from the translational velocity, some component from the rotation. Right. Translational velocity is center of gravity, center of mass, rotation of rotational energy about the center of mass. Right? And that should align with the first set of lecture notes you should have looked at last week, that we can describe the motion of a body by the translational motion of some point on that body plus some rotation about that point. Right. So this follows nicely on that first set of notes from last week. Okay? We also get one special case, perhaps. If a body is in pure rotation about some point, what's its energy? Say pure rotation about point O, let's say. Just the rotational part, right? If we're saying we're in pure rotation, we don't have translational, right? Where we have the angular momentum about point O. It's not about the center of mass anymore. So this is only valid or periorotation about 0.0. Right, this is a common mistake. Right, you have some pendulum is actually moving through space and pendulating, and you try to use this form. Can't. You got to use the total form because it's not in pure rotation. Questions about kinetic energy? All right then. Let's talk about inertia. We're going to first talk about moments and products of inertia. Which is section 5.2.1 in the book. So we're going to think about this. We're going to look again at our collection of mass. We have some body here. There's some tiny little piece of mass we're going to call dm. Or kind of infinitesimally small piece of mass. We're going to have some frame fixed in that body, and the origin of that frame is our point A we've been talking about so far, and then we have a vector from that origin to our infinitesimally small piece of mass that is our I relative to A. And you could project this down, make it clear. It's kind of somewhere out there in the XY frame. So let's look at the contribution of kind of each piece of mass dm, infinitesimally small piece of mass dm of this body to what kind of preceding analysis. Okay. So how can we write the position of that mass, the ith mass? Right, yeah, so we can just do something like that. Okay. If we take the summation from our preceding analysis, and now we're talking about not actual point masses, right, we're talking about infinitesimally small masses dm. What does that summation turn into? It's just integral, right? Think about how you learn calculus. Right? So summation, what we're summing over gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, which is integrals. Right? So what we really have then, if we look at angular momentum about point A, right, is a triple integral, because we have three coordinates to sum over. It's crossed with. We look at the angular velocity of this guy. We know we can write that as just components in ijk as well. And that's integrating all over all of those little tiny masses in the body. All right. If we do that, this is going to reduce too. And we'll define what all these eyes are pretty soon. Double check to make sure I got this order right before you copy it now. Minus. Let's rest. I'll write these as ZX and the Z's first and the Y first there. And what I missed here is these are the directions, J. Okay. So let's look at what these terms are. What do we call those three terms? Yeah, those are moments of inertia. Okay, we have some terms left. What do we call those? Yeah, products of inertia. When do products of inertia, or what contributes to them? Where do they kind of result from physically? So products of inertia are reflective of the symmetry or lack thereof of the body, the mass distribution, around the axis being considered. Moments of inertia, products of inertia. In practice, you will rarely need to calculate these by hand. Right, you'll have lookup tables, and what we'll see is we can take, even if you have some strange body, typically you can divide it into sections for which you know the, you can just look up the products and moments of inertia as necessary, and then apply some transformations that get us to the axis we care about. Let's look for a second. I think we can fit this. Everybody got the moments and products written out? If so, I'll give space to write this in a slightly different notation that you'll see. It's particularly useful when you get to actually implementing this computationally. You can write then that if we look at this, I omega, where you can write inertia matrix, where we have products of inertia on the diagonal, I mean the moments of inertia on the diagonal, and the products on the off diagonals negated. Okay. If we're looking at this, what would make our life easier? It was identity matrix. Yeah, that's exactly, that would make it really easy, right? But you're on the right track. If we can often get to the identity, but we can get to a diagonal matrix here. So if we have no products of inertia, right, all these off-diagonal terms go away. Right? You see those products are the only terms that are on the off-diagonal. Right? If there are no products, if no products, I always forget whether that's AL or EL. It's an AL, really. Principal. That makes sense. Okay. So remember that these moments and products of inertia, because of how you're doing this integration, right, are reflective, are representative of what the coordinate system you've chosen to calculate them in, and where you've chosen to calculate them about. So another simplification we can make is choosing a set of axes where the body is basically symmetric about that and all the products go away. So it's another choice we have when we're getting ready to select frames for a particular problem and where those frames need to be located within a body. So if we can select a set of principal axes, meaning that all the products of inertia go away, they're all zero, then we end up with just the moments of inertia on the diagonal of this matrix. This gets really simple for us. Okay. So if we can do that, if we can select these principal axes and not have to worry about those products of inertia, why would we ever not do this?
Rotate about, so we can always choose that we don't have those products, right?
Yeah.
So, okay.
So why would, and if you can do that, why would you ever not want to do that?
Would it be too complicated to find each of those components?
That's one reason. It can be hard. If you have a weird shape, it can be hard to find those. Actually, they're we'll see there is a transformation that you can go from any coordinates to the principal axes. So can do that. What else? Well, we're saying that, hey, that makes this thing really simple. Okay. But the inertia matrix there is not the only component, right? Right? So these guys have to be in the same frame, right, for this math to work out. So if you pick a set of principal axes, yeah, you get rid of those products, but that set of axes could make defining your angular moment, your angular velocity in that coordinate frame difficult, depending on the problem, right? So it's not the only piece of the equation we need to worry about. Okay, let's look at a slightly different way to think about the moments of inertia. So if we have, I'm going to call it IPP is some moment of inertia. It could be XX, YY, or ZZ. This applies to all of them. It's a moment of inertia. Okay. We can define a constant. You'll typically see it's some kind of kappa-looking thing. Of P. Is that. Or, written another way, end up with that. That constant is called the radius of gyration for that particular moment of inertia. What is that telling us physically about that system? What is this? I mean, it's a distance, it's a measure of displacement radius. What kind of body has a moment of inertia? It looks something like this, 1/2 m times some distance squared. Translational, this could be in rotation. This is basically telling us what radius of a thin ring it would take of mass m to have the same moment of inertia as your body. Right? This is the moment of inertia calculation for a thin ring about an axis, about its center. Right? So if I did have a thin ring, P, mass m, and I want the moment of inertia of that ring is this, about its center. It's that. Okay. So this gives us basically what radius thin ring of mass m would take to match the moment of inertia of our body. Okay. How is that useful? Well, writing it this way can quite often simplify your equations of motion and your description of a body. If you can do this calculation, that radius of gyration can make calculations quite a bit simpler, equations looking simpler, math working out simpler for you. So remember that you have this option. Okay. Questions? All right. So I'll leave up there some of it. Leave the body for now. So the first one we're going to talk about in terms of these transformations, and we kind of already talked through it at a high level, is that, hey, if I have some body, it's made up of some segments, sub-segments, that I can calculate the moment of inertia about point A for, and the total moment, total inertia properties of that body are just the sum of those. Okay, so let's see how we want to write that. We can write inertia property, let's do zeta n, I think that matches the book's notation, of the total body equals either one of those can be any of the pairs you need. Okay, so basically the total body body 1 plus body 2 plus body n. All right. So that one's, I think, makes some physical intuitive sense as well. I'm guessing you have seen this one. Parallel axis theorem gets us between axes that are parallel. So if we can write B relative to, we're going to say this is G now to match the book's description here. Oops, that one's not mine. If we call that XB and of course in this case we're just translating, right? There's no rotation there, so each one of these unit vectors would also align in the original axis. Okay. So if we had moments of inertia already calculated about the original set of axes, we can just use this transformation to get to the new ones. Okay. So moments of inertia are pretty easy. Products of inertia are also easy. Okay, so we had moments and products of inertia defined about some frame. We can just translate that frame over, it hasn't rotated at all. We can use parallel axis theorem to get us the moments and products of inertia about our new frame with it. Okay. So the probably most common one of these you have seen, I know you guys that had me for vibrations have seen this one. If you calculate the, you have a thin beam or a thin rod about its center of mass, it's of length L. What's its moment of inertia about its center? It's just that, right? What's its moment of inertia about it, its endpoint? So this is about the center. You can do the calculation. Do this to get there. And that's all that comes from. Strictly from that. Okay. So if I have the other case. So let's look. So that's parallel axis theorem. What now if I have some set of axes of the same origin? It's going through a series of rotations, so the origin's the same. Whatever rotations we've done, we end up with x prime, y prime, z prime, still has the same origin. How do you think I get to the inertial properties with respect to the new axis, new set of? So how do I get from inertial properties from the original x, y, z to the same moments and to the moments and products of inertia about this double prime axis? So we can use for rotation. Right, we have this concept of these rotation matrices. So let's define, you know, rotation matrix R is the rotation matrix that describes a rotation from our original frame to the new double prime frame. Well, then we know we can just do this. The moment of the kind of inertia matrix at that new frame is just that. Again, knowing those rotation matrices and how to combine multiple rotations into a single matrix gets you that moment and product of inertia for rotations about a point. Questions? The order is backwards for that, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. Right? Because if it's kind of, if this was coming after that, it's body fixed rotations and have to come up front. Questions? That's a good place to stop for today.